Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. I'm this week's host, Dixie Cochran. With me are Eddie Bug.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
And this week we're doing a deep dive. We had so much fun on our Requiem deep dive that we decided to do another deep dive. So this week we're going to be talking about Monarchies of Mal, Pan's Guide for New Pioneers, probably some Pugmire stuff. We're probably going to throw a little bit of like the whole Pugmire line in there, I'm sure, at some point.
The realms
of Pugmire, as it were. But specifically, I think we're going to try to go into Pan's Guide to Monarchies because those are a little bit newer. Yep. And they're super fun. I mean, Monarchies isn't even technically out yet, so that's exciting.
And also, we've all worked on Monarchies in some way. I think we've all worked on Pan's Guide in some way, too.
I have not. I have not actually seen Pan's Guide, so that's one that y'all are going to get to talk about more. Because that's one of the only ones, I think that's one of, like, two products for Realms of Pugmire that I didn't edit or touch.
Oh, did Maria edit that one?
Yeah, I think so.
Shame on you.
Shame on me.
Yes, yeah, for not leaping at the chance to edit a book that I developed. That's an easy job, and you know it.
I have, for what it's worth, leapt at pretty much every Pugmire project. Like, I was very excited to do Monarchies. I was very excited to do the initial Pugmire. I even did the early access, I think, for Pugmire.
Yeah,
I did. So, so I've had my hands on Pugmire pretty much since it was first coming out, which is cool.
Fine, in that case, I withdraw my criticism.
Yeah.
Right. But she only cares about core books, the good books, everything after that, you know.
This is a good way to start
it. I'm developing a non-core Monarchies book right now. What are you
talking
about?
Care.
Which means you won't edit it, so therefore I'm right.
I would argue that developing has my hands on it a little bit more than editing it. Anyway, so let's talk about kind of a broad overview. So, Eddie, if you want to describe Monarchies of Mal,
I probably should talk about the concept in general, people who aren't familiar with Pugmire.
Yeah, go for it.
The concept of the realms of Pugmire, the world that this is all set in, is that it is set far in the future of our world. So humanity is gone. Maybe they left. Maybe they died out. Maybe they evolved into crystalline thought patterns. We don't know. But they're not around anymore. And so uplifted animals have inherited the earth, so dog, cats, badgers, lizards, and the like. And so Pugmire was the first game for the line, and it was primarily focused on dogs, as the name would imply. It was primarily focused on the Kingdom of Pugmire. Monarchies of Mal came about because I anticipated this when I was working on Pugmire, but still surprised the amount of people who were like, well, can I play a cat?
I might have been one of those people.
You definitely were one of those people.
I'm a cat person. What? Sorry.
And that's grand. I mean, but one of the things that when I originally made Pugmire is like I designed it in a way that I knew that I was going to make a companion cat game. I did not want cats to be a supplement. I didn't want it to be a splat.
Right.
Because I felt that there was some interesting stuff. And also I didn't want cat people to feel like, oh, well, I get to be an adjunct to the dog game. I wanted the cats to have their own game. And so Monarchies of Mal is that game. And the idea is that there are some mechanical tweaks to it. There's some new classes, what we call callings. There's new spells. It's own distinct experience, but it's completely compatible with Pugmire. So if you make a Monarchies character, you make a Pugmire character, you can play them in the same game. And it definitely draws on my experiences working on properties like the World of Darkness, where you have cross-compatibility. Or actually, Chronicles of Darkness is probably a better example of having cross-compatibility baked in. But Monarchies, I wanted to have a very distinct experience, whereas Pugmire is a little more classic fantasy in a sense of its kind of Western European style fantasy. There's a king, there's a castle, there's a princess, all kind of the classic tropes of fairy tale style fantasy, even though it's got more depth than that. With Monarchies, I wanted a different experience. So there's a lot more Renaissance Italy, a lot more Game of Thrones, a lot more political intrigue. And so that changes the flavor of the game some. And how cats relate to humanity is different from how dogs do. And what cats do during their adventures is a little different. And there's some built-in point of contention, which I can go into at a later point, but the high level of monarchies is that it is a distinct role-playing game that happens to be completely compatible with Pugmire.
Right. The monarchies are adjacent to Pugmire, but they don't all live together in the same
right. kingdom. In fact, there's the Fearful Forest is like right in the middle of them. So if you look at the Pugmire map, you know, you have all the dog settlements, and there's a forest on the right side that kind of goes right to the edge of the map. And then when we get the monarchies map, you'll see there's a forest on the left side of the map, and it's the same forest. So basically there's this gigantic, dangerous forest between the two.
Right.
But what's in the rest of the world? What's on the rest of the map, Eddie? I want to know what's over the edge. Are there other kingdoms of dogs and cats? Are there other kingdoms of different animals that have been uplifted to this almost sapient state? Tell us now, spoilers on the podcast.
I think there might be. One of the things that I wanted to do, actually one of my intentional design goals with both Pugmire and Monarchies, is I wanted to get a little bit of old school fantasy flavor in there.
Right.
Not necessarily what I would qualify as OSR, for those people who are familiar with that term. It's not a specific rollback to 70s and early 80s gaming, but rather I wanted to draw inspiration from that. And part of that inspiration was the idea that the rest of the world is implied rather than spelled out. I enjoy setting in settings like Forgotten Realms or even Exalted, which we'll talk about next week with Eric Mitten. Having those in-depth, complex, dense worlds can be a lot of fun and engaging. But with these games, I wanted to tell people, okay, we've gone over the mountains. So now it's up to the guide to decide what's out there. And there's implications of other species. I certainly have name dropped mice, rats, the badger tribes, which includes ferrets, stoats, and similar animals. And also lizards and birds. So, I mean, there are other potentials out there. And again, individual guides can dig into that at the current time. I do have ideas for additional products. In fact, I'm in the process of writing an outline for another product, but that's outside the scope of this podcast.
Of course, we've got the Canis Minor. What would you call it? The
community content?
Yes, community content. I don't know why that completely escaped me, but we'll move on from that. As if I made no error at all. Never mention that
Nothing.
Again.
Nope.
Oh,
nope.
Damn, it's been recorded. Where people who enjoy Pugmire, enjoy Monarchies of Mao, and enjoy indeed the realms of Pugmire can create their own campaign settings within it. If you particularly have a town in mind, a castle, a house, or fallen or right. otherwise in Monarchies of Mao that you want to write up and detail, make playable, that sort of thing, then this is a brilliant tool in which to do it. For me, I love world building, especially in fantasy campaigns. And right. so, like you say, Eddie, with that sort of second edition feel where you have a part of the map, and to go back to Forgotten Realms briefly, when Forgotten Realms was first put out there, from what I recall, the only map you had was the Dale Lands. And you didn't know what was beyond it. And I believe Forgotten Realms first appeared perhaps in a Dungeon or Dragon magazine before Ed Greenwood released the first campaign setting. But that's that teaser. Okay, so we have a bit of flavor of the world. We know what some of these outsiders are, but you don't know what's just off the edge
right.
of that immediate map. That's exactly the kind of thing that community content can start filling in for your own campaigns. Mm-hmm. And I'm particularly happy we've obviously got the same thing going for Scarred Lands with the Silurian Vault, just to briefly take it away from Realms of Pugmire. It's something I'd love to see more people utilize, because obviously we've got a lot of fans out there who are writers, who want to get into writing, and it's a really simple thing to put one of these products together, even if it's just a four-pager with one piece of art. That's still potentially a calling you could play as in one of these games, or it's a list of spells you could use in one of these games, and that's enough. So, sorry to enthuse, I guess, lyrical about the community content programs that we've got going right now, but I think it opens up a whole range of worlds we can explore with Realms of Pugmire and Scarred Lands both.
No, absolutely. And we've talked in the past about using community content as a way to kind of, we're talking about the submission process. We mentioned that community content can be a great way to kind of get your name out there. And for Pugmire specifically, that's absolutely happened. One of the people that contributed to Canis Minor was Erica Rose, and now she's writing for the Role of Good Dogs and Excellent Cats. So, I mean, that she put out a great piece. I really liked it. I talked with the developer on that. She agreed that Erica would be a great addition. So now Erica's getting actual paying work from Pugstevionomics Path to write for official Pugmire products. So that definitely is a path that happens in Pugmire's case, at least.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody writes something and they obviously get the world really well and, you know, are a decent writer, then there's a good chance like that we might call that a submission on some level. Be like, Absolutely. Okay, like this works. You did a good job.
And I mean, kind of to go back to the deep dive a bit, that was one thing when you mentioned that we worked together through Rose, but we worked together on Pugmire Early Access.
Yeah.
I remember distinctly you really kind of got the voice I was going for with Pugmire, and I remember trading emails back and forth again kind of via Rose at the time, like, you know, this is really good, more of this, less of this, and he has really insightful comments, because it is a tricky voice to get if you don't understand the property. I think it's getting easier now for people, now that there's been a few support products out there, and we've talked about Pugmire a lot and talked about monarchies a lot. Mm-hmm. But even during the process of working on monarchies, when you're giving me the edit comments back, you continue to have very insightful comments of, okay, this is really funny, but maybe not where we want to go with that. Or, okay, maybe we could inject some humor here. You were able to really kind of help me with a couple of points that I was having some difficulty trying to nail down exactly how I wanted them to land.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing about it, is that, like, You've done posts about, you know, why Pugmire Monarchies isn't a funny dog or cat game, and that is even something that is in the writer materials that we hand out. It's like, it's not a funny game, it's not a humor game, but it has room for humor more so than World of Darkness or Chronicles of Darkness, really.
Right.
So being able to put a little bit of humor in there, but leaving most of it to happen at the table, is something that I think is a little difficult to nail down sometimes. And also even just little, you know, little things. Like, I think at one point in Monarchies, there was something that said it was hair raising. And I was like, would it be fur raising? Or is that too much? Mm-hmm. But they don't have hair.
Whisker bristling.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think in that situation, I just cut it and rewrote it to avoid the issue, because it was one of those, it was either, if I stuck with hair, it sounded wrong. If I moved to fur, it sounded too punny. So it's just, right around that. And that happens a fair bit. Like, hands constantly is an issue.
Right.
Because I try to change to paws where possible, but do you go paws off?
Or you is know? It...
Yeah, is it paw to paw fighting?
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
And sometimes that works. Like, two-pawed weapons works perfectly. Paw to paw fighting, that works. But when you start getting into hand as a more esoteric concept in language...
Like, hey, will you hand me that thing?
Right, yeah, will you paw me that thing? That's not right. So, yeah.
Hey, give that singer a paw.
Right. Put your paws together. I mean, that works, you know. Yeah. But you're right. So, I mean, so there are times where it doesn't do it. And one of the only points where we use hand is the hand of man for the Church of Man in Pugmire, because man has hands. Dogs and cats don't. And that was very specific, kind of, okay, but using the language to kind of show different levels of what's going on and how the animals see themselves in comparison to this, to them, mythological race of gods.
Right.
You know, on the subject of humor, and I think this is something worth talking about, because I certainly don't want anyone who picks up Pugmire or Monarchies of Mao to think, I can't laugh while playing this, and that's definitely not what we're saying. Almost every game I have played of both of these games has definitely had humor in the first couple of sessions.
Yep.
And you know, it's because you're playing dogs and cats. It's a very it's an atypical kind of character to play in any kind of game. let alone a fantasy RPG. And so humor, as in all situations, is a fantastic way of breaking the ice, of breaking down barriers, making people feel more comfortable with the subject matter. And I would suggest to any prospective guides listening to this, guide being our GM epithet for Pugmire and Mao, is by all means play on the humor in your first couple of sessions, allow people to feel comfortable with the game and, you know, I guess comfortable in the skin of their character and the world before you start hitting them with the incredibly heavy stuff, because these games can include incredibly heavy stuff. I think it's one of those brilliant dichotomies that exists in this game, is that realistically you're playing in a post-apocalyptic world. You are exploring a civilization that has, for some reason or other, died out as we know it. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are motorways that are cracked and grown over with undergrowth, but if you clear the undergrowth, you'll see the paint on the road, and as a dog or a cat, you won't know what that paint means. You may get into this an underground bunker where there's a bunch of artifacts and treasures that are remarkably well preserved, but you're not going to know what they are, and you can only guess. And there's a very real sense you can quite easily adapt that to what would happen if humans were driven back to the Stone Age, as a famous military man once said nuclear holocaust would do to us. If when we started rediscovering our own past, would we know how to operate a blender? Would we know what it was for? You know, would we turn this into some kind of weapon? And you've got to look at those same things through that prism when you're playing Pugmire and Monarchies of Mao. You can have everything be all, to quote Moorcock, or merry old England, back when you're in the kingdom of Pugmire and cavorting with maidens and dancing in halls and generally enjoying yourself. But as soon as you are in the fearful forest, as soon as you go beyond that boundary, things get very scary indeed. And that's something I particularly enjoy about both of these worlds.
Yeah, and that's one thing that how I kind of describe it to people is I want the players to find, I want to set up the joke and let the players find the punchline. So I mean, like, in Pugmire specifically, dogs have the ability to cast magic through items. It's very much a magic wands, magic item style structure. And so there's something funny about a dog using a remote control as a magic wand. But I don't want to position that image in front of people. I want to tell people, okay, you know, they find artifacts of man that are our technology and they use as magic. Where do you go with that?
Right.
And so I've 5 or 6 different people unrelated to each other have given me some form of the, I have a remote control for my dog's wand. It's so funny. If I had told them that joke, those people would not have found that joke. So I hear the same jokes over and over again from fans, but they feel clever for finding it.
Yeah.
I don't want to diminish them, because that was the whole point. I want them to go, they found the humor themselves, as opposed to me telling them what the humor is. But also, just because that's setting humor, and that's something that's distinct, to kind of bring Matthew into this. They Came is different. It's funny because the humor comes from how people interact with each other in ludicrous situations. And so you have to set up the humor a bit more in a game like They Came from Beneath the Sea. And have explained to people, okay, this, you have to show people how those humorous interactions come about and work so they can find different humor. But you have to kind of explain the joke a bit more in something like They Came from Beneath the Sea. But it's not bad. It's just a different way of doing humor in games.
Well, I'd like to ask...
Whereas with Pugmire, it's like the...
I'd like to ask Dixie about that. But sorry, you conclude your thought if I haven't derailed it entirely.
No, that's fine. I'll finish my thought and I'll throw Dixie. It was just the fact that with Pugmire, the humor comes from juxtaposition from an external viewpoint. You know, we the players find those situations funny. The characters don't necessarily find the same thing funny. They take it very seriously. So you have to design for a certain way to make sure that humor's happening at our move. Whereas They Came, the characters also, to a certain extent, understands they're in a ludicrous situation. So the humor can work on the same level as player characters, whereas with Pugmire, the humor definitely is a divorce. So you're going to mention Dixie because she just now started editing the game, so she has maybe a different perspective on the two kinds of humor.
That is games. Exactly why I was going to mention Dixie. So yeah, well, no. In seriousness, that was what I was going to ask. You're looking at a multitude of games that have at least a certain amount of humor in, and hell, even some of our World of Darkness and Chronicles of Darkness games have a bit of black humor in them. But right, I guess when you're going for a slightly more lighthearted fare, you're probably going to angle for Pugmire, Monarchies of Mao, or They Came from Beneath the Sea. What are you finding the major differences? How would you define them?
Well, I mean, like you kind of were saying, like the humor in They Came From is baked in. Like it's supposed to be there. Even just reading the core book, I have been, you know, laughing aloud. Because it's funny. Like it's a funny book. And the game is meant to be kind of over the top, ridiculous situations. You know? Right. If you've seen even one bad 50s horror movie, you get what I'm talking about, where like everyone's just, what's this? What's that? All the main characters are kind of not the smartest usually, and they're trying to figure out what's going on, and there's always, you know, some big strong man coming in and you know, lady scientist doing her work or whatever. And so it's very much hitting that tone of like, it's a B movie. It's badly written. It's supposed to be that way. Whereas Pugmire reads more like you're reading a D&D book, or you're reading, you know, the Redwall series that I read as a kid. Where its tone is serious. There have been moments where like there's a header, I think, in Monarchies of Mao that's dogs and cats living together. And I was like, yeah. I was like, I really hope no writers wrote mass hysteria in here, because that's a joke that's going to be made at the table every single time.
It's funny story, no writers made that joke, but I have had dozens of fans saying, you should call that section mass hysteria. And it's like, yeah, I absolutely will not, for exactly that reason.
Yeah, because the minute that you have a party of dogs and cats together and you make that comment, someone's going to go mass hysteria, and it's going to be the joke, and the table's going to laugh, and it's going to be great. So yeah, so, like that's, I'm actually developing an adventure collection for Monarchies of Mao right now. Sure. You know, pre-generated adventures for various levels. And one of the things that I was very big on in my outline was like, If you have human ruins or anything, I think one of my writers is working on something that might have been like a theme park at some point. But it's very much keep in mind that the cats don't know what that is. They will not be able to say like, oh, that's a roller coaster. They'll be able to say like, oh, there's this odd metal track. I don't know what it's for. Why does it loop in on itself, you know?
Why is it twisted in such strange ways? Yeah. Was it destroyed? Is it damaged?
Right. Like, was it alive? Is it a petrified dragon? Like, we don't
know. Oh,
that'll
be cool.
Yeah.
A roller coaster dragon, that'll be amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, I've not read it yet, so I don't know how much of that got into that draft. So this is me not making promises that's going to be in the draft, just so you know. But it was an idea that got tossed around, and it was really cool, but like really making sure that you draw back on it. To where the players at the table, it will slowly, hopefully, dawn on them where they are. And that will be cool for them, because a theme park or an amusement park is something that most of us have seen at some point. But for the cats, they're treating it like an actual mystery or an actual excavation. I've seen shopping malls mentioned. I've seen hospitals mentioned. There are so many places that to us are really mundane, but to them would be, you know, chambers of wonder. However, it's still kind of funny if your cat walks into like an abandoned Hot Topic, you know, like that's still funny for the players. So yeah, really like the main difference between the two is that they came very much like gives you the humor and gives you ways to use the humor, and the humor is injected throughout the book and through the quips and everything else. Whereas Pugmire and Monarchy is like, it's going to happen at the table, so we don't have to feed it to you. Right. And I mean, you were mentioning the remote control thing. When I ran Pugmire, one of my players had a graphing calculator as their focus. And like, I think it's really common for players to gravitate towards something that in the real world has an effect that might seem like magic if you don't know what it is, but using it kind of wrong because they don't understand what it's actually for. That's something that all the players tend to do.
And that's kind of something I never really articulated, but I mean, I very much look at things like Monarchies of Mao as kind of a puzzle. from the humor perspective, it's like finding the jokes. Right. Like you talked about with the ruins, is trying to find a way to describe things so players are going in there, they're experiencing adventure, but also there's part of the head going, what is that in the real world? You know, trying to piece out, well, what's that supposed to be? I think it's also a part of the fun. And then from a systems perspective, both Pugmire and Monica's Mao are based off of a derivation of the OGL, specifically the D&D 5th edition OGL. Mm-hmm. And so it looks a lot like Dungeons & Dragons, but that was part of the old school fantasy reference I kind of wanted to make, was that that part of it was I wanted to have a sense of nostalgia of, I remember when these games came out, and I know how D&D works, even if I haven't played it for 20 years. I recognize these dice, and those numbers look familiar. It works very differently, but it feels like the idealized version of the game you remember. But some of that also is there's a natural place to start to work in what D&D tropes map to in Pugmire.
Right.
So, like, on a very obvious level, callings are classes. So, like, the Guardian, it's like, okay, the Guardian, I'm sorry, for Monica's Mount Champion, as the champion is basically the warrior that goes out and fights people but has some charisma. Oh, that's your fighter class. That's,
right.
That's a charisma-based fighter. The Mancer is the magician that summons creatures from the dead or talks to spirits or has kind of elements of the spirits. Like, oh, that's your witch or necromancer. And so on. Like, you know, the Wanderer uses martial arts and wanders around to try to right wrongs. Like, oh, that's your monk. So people, I think, just to a certain level enjoy that little bit of how that works. But then it extends to, like, the enemies. One of the things I had Rob Weiland's work on the enemies for both Pugmire and Monarchies of Mal, and one of the things we talked about was having a certain amount of characters in there that are inspired by classic D&D monsters.
Right.
So there's a gelatinous polyhedron that, you know, has certain effects. It's kind of an homage to gelatinous cube, but it does different stuff. There's one, I think it's in Mao. It's a floating orb that has all these different kind of hoses that suck life essence out of people, but also shoot various different kinds of energy, which is kind of an homage to the Beholder. And some people have gotten those, some people haven't, and that's fine. You can play the game either way without catching those references, but it adds an additional level of enjoyment, and that's absolutely intentional. I think that part of the fun of post-apocalyptic gaming, as I'm finding out with Dystopia Rising, is that level of how do you reimagine your everyday worlds into a new context.
Right.
And so, but I wanted to extrapolate that to not just the world, but also our relationship with domestic animals, our relationship with the Dungeons & Dragons system, how the Dungeons & Dragons system generates certain effects. All that was kind of baked into every level of the game. So a lot of it was very intentional. So it's not just, okay, I took the OGL, find and replace a few words and sold it. You know, there's
right.
a lot more that's happening there.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that's cool about the world of Pugmire and Mao is that because it is far future, we're not limited to what human technology is today as far as
right.
what they can find and what they can interact with. You know, there could be cell phones that still work because their batteries have lasted that long. You know, they can
mm-hmm.
still light up. They can still do things. It's not so post-apocalyptic that, like, nothing ever works.
Right.
But also, we very much leave the question open as to what happened to humans, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, was there an alien invasion at some point? We don't know. Like, could they find a spaceship? Maybe. I don't know. They could find whatever they want. Like, whatever you can dream up can be in there.
That's the thing. Something uplifted the animals, and it doesn't necessarily have to have been human.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. So there's all kinds of open-ended questions in it, which I think is really cool in a game, because it really gives you room to explore and world build on your own.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you aren't comfortable doing that, or you don't want to go that deep into it, you can run a game just in Pugmire, or just in Monarchy's Mao. And you don't have to go into all these, you know, crazy situations that we talked about.
No, totally. And that's definitely something I was very passionate about, especially for Monarchy's Mao, is that because there's a political layer of it, there are six houses of cats. And then there's a seventh group called the Shadow Block, which are basically all the cats who didn't have a noble house. They're trying to band together to have a political force in the monarchies.
Right.
So, I mean, if you want to get to Game of Thrones or Machiavellian levels of intrigue. You can. You can do Vampire the Masquerade with cats if you want to. That level is there. But if you also just want to play a big fluffy cat with a battle axe that goes off and smites demons, you can absolutely do that too, and there's no issue whatsoever. The game works just fine on either level. I mean, that's something I've always kind of wanted to bake into the game, is that if you want just a fun, lighthearted fantasy game, that's out of the box. You don't have to apply anything extra, but there's always that depth there that you can find. It's like, you know, why is there... There's references to a seventh house, you know, but in the in-game fiction, all the references to seventh house are blocked out. What's that all about, you know? And so it's interesting layers and levels that are happening there that I want people to dig into and have fun with.
That's a different kind of...
Smite things again.
Well, yeah, it's a different kind of fantasy, different kind of darkness. When you start inserting the political element in, the idea of... as you say, stripping—it's like demolishing all the statues of a certain pharaoh. You know, knocking all that pharaoh's names off of all the pyramids and the like. As soon as you start putting that into your fantasy setting, that adds a lovely air of mystery. A mystery isn't something that you often see as a feature in games, as a core facet of a tabletop role playing game. Even I would say when you're looking at a game like Call of Cthulhu, where you are by default playing investigators, you're not generally solving a mystery. You're being confronted with a truth. It will probably find you whether you want it to or not. In a game like Monarchies of Mao, where you do have this inbuilt mystery into the very structure of your society, and more broadly, you've got this mystery of what the hell happened to the humans that were here before us. That's just for me as a guide, as a player, fuels stories. You know, I can write campaigns around mysteries alone. And I think it's a wonderful feature that exists as part of these games. One thing I actually wanted to ask, and in fact I'll ask both of you, it's a bit of a funny one, because Eddie, you mentioned about the monsters in Pugmire and Mao having to, in some cases, they've got D&D analogs. I worked on the antagonist, the adversaries for Modern Age by Green Ronin Publishing with our very own Megan Fitzgerald. And we wrote that for Modern Age, and we've both been lucky enough to work on a couple of other Modern Age books, which have not yet been announced or released. But the interesting thing that I find about writing these creatures, these enemies, antagonists and the like that you go up against, is making them different enough from the original source, or making them distinct enough from, if you take a game like Modern Age, a lot of these antagonists are going to be things like cops, robbers, and rather typical human foes. In a game like Pugmire, of course, you've got more fantastical freedom. But how do you... Where's the line, I guess? And I'm asking Dixie as well, because this is, I guess, it's a question of pure imagination, but you want it to be connected enough to the source material, but it needs to feel distant enough to feel distinct, so people aren't just reading it and thinking, well, I could just look at my monster manual and get this exact thing. What some good ways do you feel of adding flavor that makes it feel distinct to this setting?
So when I was initially working on this, and then when I was chatting with Rob about this, one of the things I kind of want to settle on is that I don't want people to ever look at a monster and go, I know exactly what that is.
Right.
But at the same time, they have to have some context. And you're right, it is a tricky balance. So one thing that I realized after we finished Pugmire that I wanted to do for Mao was that we didn't really have a dragon. And it's like, well, that seems like an omission. And initially it was because I just didn't want to do anything like that. I wanted to make sure this just had its own interesting context and stuff. But it's a very iconic monster for a fantasy game. So we decided to, instead of looking at European dragon myths, we went to Aztec. So we have a Quetzal. It's what we call the Quaddle, but it's very heavily inspired by different mythologies to give it a different flexure. But it's a giant lizard with wings. So it's like, okay, I know what that's supposed to be. And we did the image, when we did the art for it, I remember chatting with Mike about this, and it was like, you know, the wings should be on fire, and the dragon looks like, you know, as opposed to shooting fire, it itself is on fire and has these brilliant, vivid colors. And we managed to get an image that looks really, really amazing. But so when you look at it, you go, oh, that's supposed to be a dragon, but it doesn't look like a dragon you've necessarily seen before from a classic D&D perspective. It's similar. We have also, how did this come to be? Like, we have shadow felines in Pugmire, which basically, you know, these strange spiritual cats that harass dogs. And then in Monarchy of Zumao, we have them again, but also the creature that makes those. And so it's the, oh, I see how those connect now. Because shadow felines, I mean, you know, shadow cats, those kinds of monsters are a pretty common D&D trope. But the, oh, this comes from a very different place than we do now, really adds that texture to it. Also, we have the advantage of, because we're not assuming magic exists by default, it's all on some level advanced technology. Even if it's extremely technobabbly, hand-wavy technology, there's some places where the magic gets a little fanciful from a technological standpoint, and that's intentional. But still, we have that conceit. So, you know, it's like, what is a demon? What is a undead? Just having me think about what those answers are, or at least a direction where those answers could come from, gives a different tone and texture. So it's not an animated statue. It's some flavor of robot. That gives it a different flavor and texture. So sometimes that's enough. And we're able to do things like animated armor is conceptually identical to how it is in D&D, but how we describe it and how we position it and then tweak some of the stats, players going, oh, it bleeds lightning. Oh, that's electricity because it's a robot. Okay, then you're engaging with it on a different level, even though you recognize the template the hole is trying to fill.
Right. That's what I was going to say. It was one of the things that we can play with that D&D doesn't really play with is tech-based enemies. There are various enemies that are obviously robot-y drone-type things, but right. we don't describe them in such detail because, once again, cats don't know what that is. So that's kind of a nice place to come from, where you can go like, oh, there's this weird metal arm thing that comes out of the water and attacks you. But what is that? What was it originally for? We don't know, you know?
Yeah. I mean, one of the very early playtests for Mao, they went to this a tower, which I knew was basically, it was an experiment in trans-dimensional engineering. So the tower is much bigger on the inside than the outside. Insert your own Doctor Who reference here. But at one point, they trip an alarm, and the lights turn red. But they don't have context for overhead lighting or how that works. So I described it as everything in your vision feels like it's covered in blood. And that set a very different tone for them than just, oh, the emergency lights went on, you know? And say, there's this howling sound in your ears is coming from everywhere, and your eyes feel like they're covered in blood. And it's like, oh my God, we need to get out of here as fast as possible. So, I mean, it really got freaked out, which is what I was going for, because I just had to find language that wasn't the obvious thing. And then afterwards, players would ask, usually, it's like, what was that all about? And I could explain, I see that.
Yeah.
Which, again, is part of the fun, I think.
Well, yeah, because saying, you know, oh, all the light turned red, that feels very mundane. Like, right. Oh, an alarm went off. Okay. Like, we all know what that is. So finding right. a way to describe it that's not obvious is actually part of the fun of being a guide for Pugmire, I think, being so, like trying to figure out how to say things in a way that they don't realize what kind of human relic they're dealing with.
Yep.
If they are dealing with human relics. But yeah, like, that's right. That's always really fun.
Another challenge I made for myself on this front, and I know Matthew and I have talked about this on Pan's Guide, was that I don't want to have a species that is the default evil characters.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are characters that fill the roles of dark elves or orcs or whatever, but I did not want to push them as, these are the bad guys that you must kill because they exist.
Yeah, like rats aren't evil. There are evil rats, and we've had evil rats in a couple of things, but rats as a species aren't evil.
Right.
No, let's be plain here. There's been plenty of either propaganda, cartoons or whatever that anthropomorphize certain animals as certain people from certain cultures,
right,
that is deliberate in its attempt to vilify those people. And we need to be very careful as writers and developers, editors and artists, to ensure that we are making no, even unintentionally, that we're making no allusion toward that. And that can actually be quite tricky. It's obviously, it's incredibly worthwhile being that diligent, and we always will be, or we'll certainly always endeavor to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very easy to fall into the trap where you make, and I'll again, speaking candidly here, where you make a rat into a sneaky character who is going to betray you and is picking your pocket or the like.
Yeah. And now, they have a long nose and they're obsessed with wealth. And
exactly. You start going down that road, even if it's for just one character. Mm-hmm. And quite rightly, you will get some critics who will say, this sounds very familiar to something that would have been published in Disturma from 1933.
Right.
And clearly that's not what we're going for in Pugmire and Monarchies of Mal, or indeed any other role-playing game on which we're working. But that doesn't mean, you know, we need to be very careful with this kind of thing, with our depictions of how animals behave. So it makes perfect sense that we can't just have a purely bad race. And I would go so far as to say that in Dungeons & Dragons, any purely bad race is fairly lazily written. That's controversial. Sorry, all you old school gamers.
I will say that they have gotten better, but yes, certainly there is a long tradition of dark-skinned evil races in D&D.
Oh yeah, well that's a whole other podcast to talk about that, but that's definitely the case. And whether that is born from racism or not, and I think there's a fair argument to say it isn't. It's the idea of darkness, as in night, that is scary, but that doesn't mean the comparison isn't being made by some people. And right, that can be bad enough. This went to a very, very serious place all of a sudden, but it's worth talking about.
Right. Well, I brought it up because I know that it was something that came up in Pan's Guide, and it was completely unintentional. None of the writers at all ever gave me an indication that they were doing it intentionally. I noticed, because I'm thinking about that, it's like you can't position one of the races as being explicitly evil, or have all the exemplars of that race being positioned as explicitly evil. Because it goes back to how to reposition those D&D tropes, is that it's one thing to say, okay, dogs hate cats, so all cats are evil, and dogs should just kill cats on sight. It's another thing to say, well, my friend can play a cat, so now how does the dog and cat antagonism work?
Right. Like, they have to have a history to make the antagonist happen. So, right.
Anyway, I was just going to say, it's like that's something that when we started, Matthew and I started talking about Pan's Guide, is that that's a tricky balance, because with the design of that, we needed to make sure that these characters are being positioned in a very clear way, because Pan's Guide was designed to be a very introductory product.
Right, which I actually was about to ask about. Maybe this would go to Matthew or Eddie, who wants to answer it. But like, Pan's Guide for New Pioneers is one of the few books for this whole, you know, thing that I have not read. So what's it all about? Tell me. Educate
Dear
me.
God. First things first, I will say to you, and I'll say to you, Dixie, but I'll mostly say to you, the listener, if you've not picked up Pan's Guide for New Pioneers yet, pause the podcast, go to drivethroughrpg.com and buy a copy. And don't worry, we'll wait. So, now that you've bought your copy of Pan's Guide, I don't need to tell you about how fantastic it is, but I'm going to. Damn it, I should be selling second-hand cars, shouldn't I?
or first-hand cars. I have faith in first-hand cars.
No, I don't think I could ever reach that giddy height. I do wax lyrical about Pan's Guide for New Pioneers, and I'll be honest, the reason why is because this book was somewhat arduous in the making. Yes. Eddie and I went over it and over it and over it. I think that was the number of times we went over it in order to make it the book we wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. And at its simplest, it's a starting adventure. It is simply an adventure that gets a new roleplayer or established roleplayer into the world of Pugmire, and if you've never roleplayed before, into roleplaying. So it has all the tools there that you need, not only to play Pugmire, but also play Pugmire without the core rulebook. You can play Pan's Guide on its own, as its own supplement, and it's a fully fledged adventure that will probably take you 1 3-hour, 4-hour session, maybe two, depending on the tangents that your players follow. Mm-hmm. And it has the characters that you need to play in there. It has all the spells written up that they use and so on. So everything you could possibly need as a player is in there. And what's more, everything you could possibly need as a guide is in there, because it has all of your monsters statted up that appear in the game. It has all of your supporting characters that appear in the game statted up too. And we went for a very interesting layout with it, and I will always extend my praise to Mike Cheney on this, because he did a stellar job, absolutely stellar. I've never seen a book laid out so well, and I know that that may sound hyperbolic, but we really wanted to go for the idea of ease of reference. So the initial idea was, on your left-hand page, you have your scenario. So this is where the guide reads from. So this is where the guide is saying, you walk into a town and then a moon falls out of the sky. What do you do? On the right, so the adjacent page, you have the rules for that moon. What happens if it hits you? How do you roll to avoid it? And then on the page following that, you have fiction, which is Pan, our NPC, our guide, who is leading you through this adventure by pages from his diary that you can basically read as you go along. This fiction is the pages from his diary. So the guide can read through it, he can pass it to a player to read it, or if you're playing from a PDF copy, you can print it out and give it out as an artifact. And then on the fourth page, you have art that is associated with that particular chapter of the scenario. Now, that that perfect even spread isn't something we managed to hit dead on. Instead, I feel we went for something better. Sometimes you've got 2 pages of scenario and a half page of rules, because you don't need that many rules for that particular piece. Or the art only occupies half a page, because we really wanted to put a little more fiction on there. So it's not a perfectly symmetrical book throughout. It's
But the spreads are hitting correctly.
Exactly. And that was what was really important to me. Because also, if you're the guide, you're running it from a PDF, you can just skip to the page, you know, to the next page that you need to navigate to. You don't need to go through the entire book. The next page you need will always be the next page. Mm-hmm. Or if you need to refer back, it's the previous page. And that's it. There should be no cross-referencing, flipping backwards and forwards throughout the entire book. And of course, the adventure itself is a great deal of fun as well. It's an adventure that takes you from Pugmire itself, takes you through the forest, takes you to parts unknown to get our obligatory wrestling reference in. And that's a very obscure wrestling reference, but parts unknown is a place in the world of wrestling.
Yes, it is.
And has you uncover what is potentially a very powerful artifact, because the Kingdom of Pugmire has been beset by floods and washed an awful lot of homesteads away. You might be able to reverse that effect if you succeed. Now, I extol this book's virtues wholly, and I don't claim royalties from it, so I can't blame that. I do that because I've worked on an awful lot of books now, and this is a book that I can look at on my shelf and look at with a huge amount of pride. It's well written, it's well edited, the art is brilliant, the layout is perfect, and what's more, that's not all you get with this brilliant second-hand Buick. You also have a Choose Your Own Adventure YouTube video series that goes with it as well. So if you want to play through that beforehand, if you want to go along that adjacent to the game to see how Pan went on his adventure, because that's what the Choose Your Own Adventure is. It's the adventure that took place before yours that led to the journal entries that you now have in Pan's Guide for New Pioneers. You can go through the YouTube adventure, where each video is a different part of the Choose Your Own Adventure. So, of course, you start on video 1, you then go to video 2, then that might take you to video 3 or 4 or maybe 5, depending on the choice you pick. Each video that you can get to is linked in the description below the video you're playing. It's a really good way of easing a new role player into the world, into the game. And I've received some wonderful words back from families who have played Pan's Guide because it's such a simple one to just get the hang of for children. And one of those wonderful things that Pugmire and Monarchies of Mao are good at. I know we don't advertise it as a children's game. It's not. There's some very dark elements. But it is a game that you could quite comfortably play with the family and not come across any controversial elements. So, that's my piece that done. It's been long and I need to take a breath, but that's my piece done.
Well, I mean, take a breath. So stop talking about yourself so I can talk about you for a bit. because, I mean, that is the key thing. I want to touch back on the Not a Kid's Game in a second, but I do want to finish my thought in the sense that when I first came up with this, something that Rich and I talked about, we realized during the Pugmire Kickstarter that a lot of people who were new to role-playing games were showing up in the Kickstarter because they were asking questions that to us seemed very obvious, like, where do I get dice for this kind of things?
Yeah.
So it was very clear that people who had never played a game or who had tried it and didn't like it were coming to Pugmire. And so Rich and I decided we wanted to put out a product that was not our usual jumpstart, because a jumpstart requires a certain amount of knowledge of how RPGs work.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though we did a Pugmire jumpstart for that, we got a stretch goal and it got hit of a more introductory product. And so I gave Matthew what was a very difficult brief. You know, it's this game that you've never developed before. No one's ever developed before. He was the very first developer. It wasn't me for Pugmire to do a kind of product we've never done before to a very strict structure that tells a very simple adventure in which it is framed by a character who not only has an unseen adventure that we never see, but also is a notorious liar.
Right.
So we have fiction that is unreliable, but evocative. And to communicate all of this to people who maybe have never played role-playing games before, it's a massive challenge. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why I asked Matthew to do it, is because I knew that he could take on this challenge. I knew he got the voice. I knew he understood how to make a product like this.
Mm-hmm.
But it was challenging because there were so many things that we had just never done before. We never made an interactive YouTube video story before. We've never made a product like this before. We've never done this kind of how do we explain a role-playing game in a step-by-step format before. It's all sorts of stuff we've never done, both as a company and just as individuals. So it was a lot of hard work, and absolutely all kudos to you, Matthew, because I think you did a brilliant job pulling this off. You had a fantastic team, but I mean, you were very much in the thick of it, making sure every piece was lining up the way that we had talked about.
It's one of those odd things, isn't it? Because you, in this industry, well, for Onyx Path, you can get to a certain point where you've worked with a company for long enough that you may be able to get something called paid on delivery,
mm-hmm.
which is where when you turn your work in, you get paid your money. You're not waiting for anything to be published to get paid half. And that will usually come after you've done a lot of projects, hit deadlines all the time, deliver good quality, that kind of thing. But my point is I got paid about halfway through this one,
mm-hmm.
because I had delivered the book. The final drafts were all in. I received my fee. And then I carried on working on it for about a year and a half without any extra money. This isn't me complaining. Eddie, where's my fucking money? there we go. We did say beforehand, where's all the swearing?
Now we know.
Yeah. But it's this is one of those interesting things about the industry, because we spoke about freelancing the other week. Is sometimes you have to invest your time in a product because you need to see it through to the finish.
Right.
And not because, you know, if you've already been paid, you've been paid for work you're about to do. It's not just work that you've done. And any developer who might get paid halfway through, well, that doesn't mean your job's finished. You've still got half a job to do. You're just, you know, you've just been paid in half in advance.
Yeah, and it means that we trust you to finish it at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it was it was quite an odd feeling, because I think this is the book that I clung on to for longest after having been paid. And I imagine some people would probably say, just put it out. You know, you've already been paid, move on to the next project. Mm-hmm. But this one, and I can't really explain why, but I guess to get back to my original declaration about this book in particular, is... seriously, if you're listening to this and you're not a fan of Pugmire, you've not played Pugmire, or you have played Pugmire, this book is, well, costs less than Pugmire. So if you want to know what Pugmire is like, pick this up, because this has everything you need in it to play this book out of the box, as they used to say, and you don't need to do anything else. If you like it, brilliant, then you buy the full game. If you didn't, wonderful. You've got an adventure you can run for new role players if you ever want to, but at least, you know, you weren't burnt, as it were, by buying a core book that you didn't like. I just think there's so many facets to Pan's Guide as a product. I would love to do a similar thing for other games at some point in the future, but really that's contingent on the success of this book. So it's been out for a month or so now, and we'll have to see how it does long term. But I guess that original inspiration to do those video guides was because an awful lot of board games now, although they'll of course come with the rule book, they will refer you to a video on YouTube that teaches you how to play. And I thought, I want that for a role-playing game. Yes, we have Geek and Sundry. Yep. We have lots of live plays of lots of games on YouTube and Twitch now. But we don't really have any tutorials of how do you play a role-playing game or a choose-your-own-adventure that immerses you in the setting. And so we have that for Pugmire. And I hope people listening check it out and let us know what you think.
Yeah, absolutely. We're getting close on time, so I'm going to throw it to our socials and stuff in a minute. I do want to say to listeners, check us out on iTunes, Google Play, all that stuff, Podbean, OnyxPathBlog. You have lots of places to find us. If you find us through iTunes or similar, please rate and review. That's how we get more listens, and that's also just how we know how we're doing. Feel free to leave comments on the blog or on Podbean or on places all over Facebook. We can be found just about anywhere. Type in Onyx Path in your Facebook search, and there's a discussion group. There's the actual, you know, page. So you get lots of places you can chatter with us. Speaking of, I'm going to ask you guys not just for your social media stuff, but also say what one thing you really love or your favorite thing about Pugmire or Monarchies when I throw it to you. So, Eddie?
Well, my favorite thing about both Pugmire and Monarchies of Mal is that it's something that I own. It's something that, I mean... I'm the mercenary level of, you know, hey, this is all mine, I got the money for it, but more the fact that it's something I have complete control over. A lot of my work is licensed work or working with a different company or, on an Onyx Path case, working with Onyx Path's own properties. So having somebody say, no, I want to do this, and that's what happens, is genuinely cool to me. So I always appreciate that. And in fact, if people want to get all the Pugmire stuff in one place, because there's a lot of it and it's kind of all over the place. If you go to realmsofpugmire.com, I have a website there that will give you a brief breakdown of it. It has some art there, and then also all the stuff you can purchase and some rules clarifications, a link to the blog, all that fun stuff. If you wanted to chat with me, however, you can find me just about every social media website at Eddie Fate, that's EddieFate, or you can find me at my website, which is EddieFate.com.
All right, Matthew?
My favorite thing, I'll stick to Monarchies of Mal. My favorite thing on Monarchies of Mal is the houses. I love games with inbuilt politics, with dynamics like that, where you can start playing your background, your culture, and it doesn't necessarily have a material effect or so much of one on the mechanics of your character. While yes, the houses do grant you certain bonuses, modifiers and the like, in Monarchies of Mal, I liken the houses in that game to your factions in Planescape, your clans in Vampyre, your factions indeed in the Contagion Chronicle as well. Mm-hmm. It's that added layer for me of politics, of diplomacy, that makes Monarchies of Mao really spring out to me in a very vivid way. And I hope to be able to write more about the houses in future, as Eddie well knows. but even if I don't get to, I hope to see someone else doing so, because I think there's an awful lot of land that can be tilled on that subject. Mm-hmm. My social media is Gentleman Gamer, the Gentleman Gamer, I should say. No, I'm not just a Gentleman Gamer.
The definitive article, you might say.
Yes, well, quite. The Gentleman Gamer on the Onyx Path forums. I'm the Gentleman Gamer on YouTube. I am Clack Click Bang on Twitter. And you can probably find me on Facebook as Matthew Dawkins.
I think my favorite thing about Pugmire and Monarchies as a world, the realms, if you will, is watching players play their pets, whether they're still with them or whether it's a beloved childhood pet that has passed on. The first time I ran Pugmire, every single player, when I was making, like, I was pre-genning their characters, but I let them have input, and everybody was doing some animal they had at one point owned. And people really connect with their pets, and I know that people really connect with their pets even long after they're gone. I have a dog I had when I was 5-6 years old that I still would like to play in Pugmire at some point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so watching people, whether they're children or adults, get to kind of go through and make their very, very personal connection to their character is very cool to me, because we relate with animals, I think, on a way that is almost easier to do than relate to other humans. Yes. Like, I think people feel much more personal connection when they're playing their own cat than when they're playing a half-elf ranger, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's something that I really love about it, and just watching people do it and watch people kind of light up when they realize that, you know, they're playing their character or their pet is really, really cool to me.
It is. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a really great feeling. So that's my favorite thing about it, I think, overall. You can find me on Twitter and pretty much all social media at Dixie Cyanide. That's also my name on the Onyx Path blog and forums and everything. It's where I am everywhere. You can find us at theonyxpath.com, forums.theonyxpath.com. And as always, many worlds, one podcast.